Today's program is brought to you by the Dairy Farm Families of Wisconsin, the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board. Did you know that today Wisconsin produces more than 600 varieties, types, and styles of American, international style, and original cheese that win more awards than any other state or country? To learn more, visit eatwisconsincheese.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome to The Front Burner with Jimmy and Andrew, where we serve a weekly menu of industry commentary based on what the market has to offer. I'm Andrew Friedman from Tokeland.com.
I'm Jimmy Bradley from The Red Cat.
And we are thrilled, honored, excited. How many adjectives, Jimmy?
Wicked pissa.
That was my favorite.
To have in studio this week, our old friend, and all of our listeners know him, Marcus Samuelson, Chef Marcus Samuelson.
Thank you.
Welcome, Marcus.
Thank you so much. Excited to be here.
We're thrilled to have you back. We've got Marcus here for a couple reasons.
Yes, we do.
One is, you know, Marcus was here last, I guess, late last spring.
Yeah.
And in the intervening time, we had hoped to have him back. We didn't get a chance. We actually took a hiatus in the fall. But Marcus's latest cookbook came out, the Red Rooster Cookbook. And it's something that we'd wanted to have a chance to talk to him about, but we were off taking care of some other business.
Sure.
So we figured better late than never, get you in here and talk about that.
You're also allowed to be off.
It's okay. We had good reasons.
Yeah, exactly.
We were off for happy reasons, but time consuming reasons. And then we have some other things. We're going to talk about some goings on at Red Rooster.
Sure.
Having to do with Black History Month, mm-hmm. and maybe just some other general
cool
talk. But before we get into the other things, can we talk, Marcus, about this cookbook? It's obviously not your first, but it's the subtitle of the Red Rooster Cookbook is The Story of Food and Hustle in Harlem. Mm. Maybe in your own words, you could just talk a little bit about it, because it is a cookbook, but it's also sort of laced with articles and profiles and other little bits and pieces that sort of give it a life that's a little different from most cookbooks.
Yeah. No, I thought the opportunity to present the community that the restaurant sits in, and we're just basically happy restaurant workers to sort of operate there, right? Like, give a little bit. We couldn't do this book without connecting the past with the present and hopefully what the future can bring, right? And so having people like Dapper Dan talk about that Harlem always been stylish. It's not a moment that happened because there's a new store opening across the street, or having a moment where, you know, talking about this mystique area of El Barrio, how is it shifted from Italian-American community, Jewish community, to Puerto Rican community that now actually happens to be some of the best Mexican food in the city is right there. Now, I love that, I know that, but I'm not the best ambassador for that. So having other people sort of talk about it in our book and really inviting the ambassador of the community to connect about where did Harlem come from, why, how did it get to this moment that it has right now, and where do we go from here? So, you know, sometimes there was a designer, sometimes it was Thelma Golden from the Studio Museum, sometimes it was someone like Lana Turner. And it's also showing the word hustle was very important for me to put on the cover, because we all know that opening a restaurant is a hustle. And, you know, when we did Red Rooster, we wanted to sort of match the energy of Harlem and Lenox, which is a hustle. So, and writing a book is a hustle. So it was kind of like a fun word to kind of, we always came back to that word.
Sure.
And this book is not done only by me. Everything we do in the restaurant is obviously a collaboration. But our restaurant wouldn't be the restaurant without the musicians, without Bobby Fischer's amazing pictures, without Hilton Al's amazing foreword. So without April, my co-writer's incredible sort of, I mean, it was people for 2 years that said, okay, we're going to live here. and we're going to give you a book.
Was this the book that you always – how long did it take you to kind of conceive the book as it exists in final form? Sure. In other words, was that a process – you know, was the book that you sold to your publisher the book that we're holding in our hands as I'm sitting here with you today? Or did it sort of evolve as you went along? Yeah. Because it is an interesting mixture, right, of elements.
Yeah.
That has sort of its own rhythm. It has a life to it that I'm imagining, having worked on books, but, you know, that it might have sort of evolved as you were going through the process of writing and of living during the time that you were doing the book.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. You said a lot of interesting crossroads there. Like, I've never felt I've gone and sold a book to a publisher because I feel like it has to evolve. Like, for me, it's like going to meet them and then let me come back to me in 3 years and then let me just do the work and,
right,
sure, edit, be on top of us. But it's really about authorship of urban food, right? It's the authorship of that. That's what's in there, actually. It's who has the authorship to that? How do we talk about the migration and this moment that we live in right now? What does the migration give to us? Plus, urban has always been cool, right? What moment has urban America not been interesting, both for our country, but also to the rest of the world? You know what I mean? How do you contextualize everything the migration gave us, from Miles Davis to hip hop to soul food to, you know, what, you know, these, to what this moment we're in today, right? And you can go up to any publisher and sell that because it's kind of like, it's too much, right? So all I want to, when I go up and do that, I'm just like, all right, we're going to do a book. It's going to be great.
Right.
It's going to be called The Red Rooster.
I'm going to talk about Harlem. Yeah. Talk about my restaurant. Yeah. Going to bring my friend.
Because, exactly. Because it's like, but so, yeah, I thought I wanted to do something like that. But the book also obviously got better than we thought because we met amazing people along the way. You know, when you start a project, it's like,
sure,
this amazing cat came from nowhere. Yeah. Well, I'm not going to edit him out because we have deadlines in 2 months.
It's kind of the same thing when you build a restaurant. You
right? Know?
You're not certain what you're going to hang on the walls. Maybe you meet somebody like you said, Bobby Fischer. Yeah. Somebody walks in.
Yeah.
Yeah, I want to use that.
And it was constantly that, you know, I wanted to show a lot of vulnerability because building Red Rooster, I was very vulnerable at the time. And not knowing, showing that I didn't know. I took the staff on a ride, but I was also on a ride, having left Aquavit, starting my new business, starting it in Harlem, and not being quite sure because I thought that was, you know, a lot of people are in crossroads in all the time, and but showing that vulnerability. It's not like we knew what we're doing, and there it is, you know, thumbs right. up all the way, showing that.
Part of it is, you know, the journey on the path as opposed to just getting there. You mentioned the migration. I wanted to just touch on, I think you allude to it as the four avenues in the book of arriving at a style of food or the way the book is, the narrative of the book. You mentioned the Great Migration. Mm-hmm. You mentioned, what else? Oh, the globalization.
Yeah.
When you mentioned current times and Excellent. You mentioned your story. And can you tell us a little bit about weaving those together and the significance of it?
Yeah, I mean, when we think about Harlem as a village in Manhattan, the Great Migration, really Southerners coming up, predominantly African-Americans coming up north, and how their food changed when it came up north. It was not like they had a farm here the way they had in Virginia. And they had to send the food through the train, through the buses in certain ways. So the food changed, right? And there were certain dishes that didn't change that much. But a lot of the vegetables changed a lot because it just wasn't the same climate. It really became about the bird and pork. Those were the two main proteins, but not the best cuts, you know. And how do you make something with how do you make chicken oyster taste like filet? We all as chefs now love that stuff, but it wasn't always a time for that, right? But then also showing that it was still very diverse, that food, because if the settler was from Holland, had a different implication. If the black maid married a Latin co-worker, it had a different outcome. That's why you had tamales in Memphis and it's considered a soul food dish. The Native American had a lot of importance. So it was a lot about talking about what the migration brought us, but then obviously global immigration, which I am a part of, right? So, you know, that El Barrio has changed from Puerto Rican to Mexican-American community, that's a sign of that. The fact that in West, in 116 starts a little West Africa, right? Which is Senegalese, Mali, a little bit Nigeria. Well, that tastes very different than Central Harlem. But maybe it doesn't, because okra and grits come from Senegal. So it does have, it's like these rivers that runs into each other, but it's not a linear path. And all we do in the book is really uploading that with great storytellings and narratives.
So, Marcus, I have a question. This is a little bit outside the book, but, you know, having known you since you were at Aquavit,
yeah,
and that was like the one restaurant where you were doing what you were doing there, you know, and then Red Rooster, and then you've had other projects since then, you know, and you've, you know, this is the Red Rooster book, right? And we say these four avenues you two were just talking about are the four avenues that kind of flow together into or converge into the Red Rooster cuisine, right? Do you think in terms of your, how do you think of your, you've written about identity a lot, personal identity.
Sure.
What about culinary identity? Mm-hmm. For you personally, like when you're home, how does Marcus Samuelson cook? Do you know what I mean? Like, that was probably a very simple answer in your Aquavit days.
Yeah.
And it's probably a much more complex answer, I would imagine, today.
Yeah. I will always lean, and this is interesting, this is such a good question, because I will always lean to the one thing that you can't see. I will always lean Japanese.
Oh, my gosh.
Well, like, if you ask me first, but...
That was a good question.
No, but like, you can't tell. The name didn't give away.
That wasn't part of the four avenues.
No. But, I mean, that's the food. If you ask me, one cuisine that I want to eat every day of my life.
Yeah.
And I think about fish more before than I think about meat. I just do. I grew up on an island.
Yeah.
And my first love for food was always Japanese food. And I'm also bad at it. I'm not good at it. You know, I think I'm good at it, but I'm not.
Sure.
You know what I mean? There's a big difference.
You're not going to hang out a shingle and start selling it.
No. But I ask me these questions constantly. Did we put mirin in there? Did we use white soy? I'm like, wait a minute. Why do you, those are the, how much umami is the miso in that broth?
Yeah.
Did we put fermented miso in the brown butter?
Yeah.
You know, those are questions that I ask myself. That just puts another bow tie on it, right? Uh-huh. But that's, you ask me, that's how I feel.
That's where you are right now. Fascinating.
What about when you get behind the stove and you're making dinner?
I love, very often, if I make dinner for my wife, it's very often she started it with an Ethiopian stew. And I love stepping into that, because no matter what you add, you can make a great pasta with some really spicy, good lamb stew, right?
Sure.
All you have to do is just like get in there, get the rigatoni going, and just like let it simmer away. So, or making great breakfast that way, like a beautiful open-faced omelette with some fresh ricotta.
Yeah, that's what came to my mind when you said that. So I'll have some grits and some eggs with it.
Yeah. So, you know, it's that's probably, we always have a good base of homemade food that she started, and then I can jump on that. So that's an easier way to start.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about two other things in the book. One of them is you have these playlists throughout the book. Where did the idea for that come from? You know, it's, people have for a long time toyed with this connection of music and food. You know, there were these CDs back, you know, like probably 20 years ago, like Music to Cook By, and there was this little phase we went through. You have these playlists that accompany certain sections in the book.
But it's really about when you operate in Harlem, you're really allowed to operate on a different grid. So you can't look at what's the latest fashion. I look at my staff, and part of my staff are the musicians. The art on the wall is not there because we like blue or green. It really informs the diner of what was here before us or where we're going. The music, like, there are 70 musicians every week that calls Red Rooster home. So I couldn't do the restaurant. I couldn't talk about Red Rooster, the restaurant, without having music in there, right? So it was also, so it's really, it's just as much part as the cooks and the dishwashers and the servers. I know that's not part of a traditional staff, but it's also nothing traditional about the restaurant. So it was important that we have original music in there. And then, you know, this restaurant we're in, Roberta, for me, is, you know, I love the word weird in a restaurant, right? Roberta is that. Harlem, coming to Harlem for a third of our audience could be weird. And I've learned a lot of good stuff in life through David Bowie, through Prince, through Miles, right? And if we don't, and music is really very often the first step when someone's like, you're going to hear a song. So that was weird, but I don't know if I like it, and go back to it. Before you come to the food very often, right? Mm-hmm. So music informs our food decision, informs our maybe openness to other people. Well, I mean, I couldn't have thought of a better time ever to present that than now, because this is the time that we need to hold on to weird differences, different smells, different music, and different food.
Is it also part of, you know, like people speak about food being the fabric, you know, of a culture or a memory, and certainly music as well. So is the music in this case like reinforcing something, or is it part of telling the story, or is it like a supplemental portion?
No, well, it's reinforcing and part of telling a story. So 2 years ago, Chinese New Year, we had an 18-piece all Chinese jazz band playing Kalamazoo's a jazz contribute, right? And it happened to be that Chinese New Year was during Black History Month. And for me, you know, all these dates and stuff like that, but for me, it's more about telling an open story. Like one of my favorite musical events was when we had a heavy metal band from Africa in the restaurant, right? And their favorite musicians was Motorhead. Right? Now that's
Lemmy.
Lemmy, exactly. No, but so now welcome to the new world, and that's what our state, that's if you have a basement in Harlem, you can't be weird. I don't know where in the world you can be allowed to do that. If you have a little stage in Brooklyn like this,
right,
and you can't have a radio show, like wherever could you have it, right? So I think it's, we need those places, and it informs us about being open-minded.
So the restaurant for you, I mean, it seems very much when you talk, you were talking, it's kind of the way you were talking about the book, you know, it seems to that it's very much a,
like an amalgamation.
A living, well, also a living thing, you know, mm-hmm. a living thing that grows and matures and changes the way a living thing does. How, I mean, maybe the answer is not so much, but how has the restaurant changed since it's open? What have been the big sort of, metamorphoses that it's gone through.
Wow, that's
and maybe that aren't even necessarily maybe behind the scenes. But
yeah. Well, there are many examples of that. Some of the traditional that Jimmy knows, that the line the prep cook became a sous chef.
Yeah.
So that's a reward and very important for the growth of the restaurant.
Right.
The phone lady is now a manager. So you have these like. The great bartender's now open his own cocktail bar down the street.
So the kids are growing up.
Growing up.
So, yeah.
But so that's normal, and that's what it
but
should
that's
be.
But that's also, I'm assuming, very satisfying for you.
Very important.
Yeah.
That's the aspiration that you don't have to leave our community, that you can come to our community and stay there and learn as a culinarian. Very important,
yeah.
Right? But then it's also that I wanted to have this very... It can't be predictable. Like we are content. I want a customer just to trust it. Go to the basement, not based on what's playing down there. Just trust us, right? And whether that's I think for Valentine's Day, we're going to have a big ass mariachi band. And it's going to be beautiful. Not expected probably, but I know it's going to be beautiful, right? And we've had Swedish choirs in there. And we've, you know, this. So just trust us versus saying, I'm coming for this and it's got to be this and otherwise
right.
It's not good. Don't force yourself upon us here now. Like we're going to give you a show and my guy's going to perform. Appreciate that.
Right.
You know?
Sure.
And that's you know, we opened with a band called Pink Martini. It was our first band that ever performed.
Oh, my gosh. From Portland?
Yeah.
I was at a wedding on Mount Hood about 20, mm-hmm. maybe 18, 20, might have been 20 yeah. years ago. Pink Martini was the band.
Oh, wow.
At this so cool. wedding before they were oh my known. God. They're amazing.
But that set the tone for me
yeah.
about what the sound and the open mind. They sing in Czechish, they sing in German, they sing in Spanish. I mean, it's basically like a Trump nightmare, right? Like you know, like...
Oh, we're going there.
Pence okay. would just walk straight out, right? Like, what is this? Or control them.
Right.
Yeah. But it's also what the restaurant is. We are a bunch of misfits. Thank God. We have always been, not always, but we always try to be very open-minded. When other businesses shied away from communities... You know, Red Cat went in, you know, or and like, you know, like there's many examples where the restaurant was only the only civil thing in that place.
Yeah.
And everything else came after that.
That's, yeah. Restaurants, there is a real history of that, especially in New York City, of restaurants making neighborhoods safe. Yeah. Restaurants making them appealing. Restaurants serving as sort of a beacon.
Absolutely. And the word restaurant means to restore a community. And without there's 160 employees there. Those 150 of those jobs you can't outsource.
Yeah.
And I love that. Whether that's the plumber, whether that's the person, our handy guy, or whether it's the server. You can't really. There's a couple of tech jobs that you can outsource there. But other than that, and it also gives an identity to that community. And so I think it's have evolved in that.
Yeah.
And then also understanding our role. Sometimes we're maybe part of the problem, but we want to be part of the solution.
Right.
So what do you do? So I think our festival very much came out of that, right? Understanding, wait a minute, it's just not all good. Rent just went up 3 times. You know all about that.
Amen.
So then figuring out, okay, what else can we do? So when we line up our 1,700 volunteers for Holla Meetup, I know we're on the right track. That doesn't mean we take wrong decisions sometimes, but I know we're pushing down the right, avenue.
Great. One other question for you. In this book, you tell certain stories. Mm. And I'd love you to just maybe tell it a little bit.
Yeah.
But, for me, and maybe it's this moment we're in right now and I'm just intensely nostalgic already, but you tell the story of when President Obama came to Red Rooster and what that meant for you. I wish people could see Marcus's the smile that just broke out when I said this. Can you just tell that story? Because I think it is one of the better, it's one of the more... you guys really, and I have to give credit to you and your collaborator, you guys really underplay it in the telling.
Yeah.
But can you just, what was that day all about? Big Wednesday, I think you called
it. Yeah, it was a Wednesday, you're right. Well, first of all, I remember the day when we got the call, and that's like any operator there is like, can you host a dinner? And the people came up to look at the restaurant, and like, it has to be in the basement because of security reasons. And we're like, don't go in our basement. Our basement is right next to the subway.
Right.
New York City subway with like 125 years of stuff, right? And these guys walk down there and like, can you fix this in 60 days? We're like, sure. And then we just went to work and fixed up the basement as good as we could. I remember the day when the president came, President Obama came to Harlem, because it was like, the Yankees and the Knicks would have won on the same day, and the party was in Harlem.
Right.
People were selling Obama cutouts, and not just taking selfies, but like selling $1 picture with like standing next to Obama. People were demonstrating pro and cons.
Yeah.
The cops and, Black Lives Matter basically were hugging.
Yeah.
There was all this, there's this other thing that goes on that was so much bigger than the president. It was actually that moment, what it meant that he actually came to Harlem.
Well, you also tell, when you're explaining all the dramatics that were going on, you guys were forbidden from disclosing that he was coming. Oh. But the word got out.
I love Harlem. It's like it's like the shower that is just leaks and leaks and leaks. People knew,
right.
People knew right away, and but it didn't. At least I didn't know from us,
right?
But I was also nervous because you're in this fishbowl with like hundreds and hundreds of people just staring in, but it was an incredible day. It was so much fun, and I remember end of the day, we just fried up all these donuts, gave them out to the cops that have worked overtime, and we had a drink. And
donuts to the cops?
Donuts to the cops! Donuts to the cops! Real donuts! But it was a party, it was a celebration, and I think it really, we've been blessed by these moments. We talked about Pink Martini setting the tone musically when President Obama came, set the tone, and restaurant has always been a place, specifically in the Black communities, a place, restaurants, basements in Black communities have always been a gathering point, sometimes to hide.
Right.
Because you couldn't gather as a group and hold meetings. When you speak to someone like Leah Chase, they had the first integrated restaurant in America, most of the Rosa Parks meetings were held in the back of her restaurant.
Wow.
And it was so restaurant means different for different communities when you kind of have to like have this sort of, you know, the speakeasy, the unofficial with a knock knock. That actually comes from somewhere of real importance because you couldn't let people in because it was really dangerous.
Right.
So I thought about that. We've hosted after that, obviously, a lot of politicians, but it's always in the basement.
Right. But, you know, I mean, I must say the Rooster is like, to me, the most perfect example of a neighborhood restaurant. And, you know, it embodies the soul and the people and the vibe of the community. And it really, it works, it integrates itself into the community and works for it. But it just doesn't stop there. It has aspirations for, you know, the whole city, the whole state, the whole country, the whole world. You know, it has world-class aspirations, but yet it keeps itself totally rooted and grounded in the moment with the people instead of, you know, it's pretty easy to get your head in the clouds when people like that are calling you.
Yeah.
It's a lot easier to have your head in the clouds than your feet on the ground when you know, instant success happens or major acclaim and notoriety. And not just for your own skill set, which is, you know, badass. You're an amazing, talented chef.
Thank you.
For putting the package together. Yeah, you know, it's like being a movie producer, you know, or being a movie director. Like you have the vision.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you get to do it. Sometimes you don't. Sometimes it translates. Sometimes it doesn't. But your stuff is, in my opinion, just spot on.
Thank you so much. And that means a lot because that's sort of, you know, the history of restaurants. And when I speak to my staff daily, you know, we don't talk so much about us, but we talk about the larger purpose, right? Why are we here?
Right.
And we also hear it's not about always filling the room downstairs. It's about presenting the community. And if there's eight people, we don't hear about the Mondays when there's eight people down there, but they're going strong, right? And I always tell that story, like, you know, when the police first played downtown, there were three people watching them, right?
Yeah,
but,
right.
You know, they didn't stop playing. They went, so, you know, they became the iconic police. So we are not editors of who's going to come out of our basement.
Amen to that. You know?
And so when somebody performs down there, if it's more service and customers, we still applauding. We have to give it everything. And it's that type of purpose that we're there for. Sometimes we do stuff that works, and sometimes we do stuff that doesn't work. But the larger purpose is to presenting the neighborhood and allowing a spoken word artist to get a Thursday versus it would be easy just to play the same stuff and so like check, but then we're not doing the purpose, and I enjoy that. And that for me is part of being successful, right? It's not just you can do more and ka-ching, you know, like that.
Right.
No, let's really look in that mirror and figuring out. So that's been a journey that I really enjoyed. And also allowing to serve different food, right? Right now we're serving a warm beef tartare that, you know, really comes from my wife's family in Ethiopia. And to serve it's a very difficult dish to serve warm beef tartare, to cook it, and for the customers to like, shouldn't it be raw? Shouldn't it be cooked more? But those moments too, those dishes doesn't always work, but that's a tiny level of success. But for us to be able to do that, yes, it should be a lot of bird and chicken on that, but it should also be other stuff.
Right.
You know,
spoken like a true chef. I mean, just the, when you were talking about the music, it just made me, it resonated with me in the sense that, yeah, of course, you know, and quite frankly, the restaurant business, you know, I would say one of the number one words is consistency, right? That's what the guest wants, you know, that's what we want to teach our staff. On the other side, you know, it's hard to get up every day to cook the same dish a couple hundred times a week, and then a couple thousand times a year. So when you were describing wanting to change the bands and the music and the, you know, spoken word and the feeling, this, you know, the fabric, the soul of it, it just is like, oh yeah, and that's exactly what you do with the menu too.
Yep. But you know, people come to New York and people come specifically to Harlem for many different things. And I think once you stop presenting creativity, we're in a very, very, very difficult spot as a city and as a community. So I think the balance, of course, is always very hard. But, you know, 2/3 of the people that come to our restaurants are either New Yorkers or come from another place, right? When they specifically come to Harlem, they want the true interpretation of jazz, whatever that, you know, that's a wide range. But if we would just put on the radio and play the simplest music and serve the same food, we would have lied to them too. So it's really keeping that North Star of creativity going. And right now we have one of our head chefs is this we have this beautiful redneck as a chef now. His name is Richard Martin Luther King, right? He's a Southern kid, he's a white kid, and he's Southerner, right? Wow. So he is this white redneck kid, beautiful, soulful chef, so beautiful in the kitchen, beautiful. And he teaches all this, you know, majority people of color staff about Black Southern traditions. And they just eat from his hands like this.
No figure, huh?
You know what I mean? But that's the rooster, right? Like, that's rooster.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Right.
When he sent me the email, I'm like, Marcus Samson does not tell so much more story. When I looked at Richard Martin Luther King, I did not expect him to walk through.
Yeah.
But no,
you guys should swap names.
We should. Yeah, to meet Richie. He's amazing. Amazing.
We're going to take a break. We have been talking with Chef Marcus Samuelson, author of the Red Rooster Cookbook, The Story of Food and Hustle in Harlem. Yeah. And when the Front Burner comes back in just a moment, we're going to talk about some current goings on at the Red Rooster and a couple of other hot topics with Chef Marcus Samuelson when the Front Burner comes right back.
Today's program is brought to you by the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board. Wisconsin produces the world's best cheese, period. Why? Lush grasslands, glacial water supply, fourth-generation cheesemakers, combining old-world tradition with the new ideas and highest standards. The very best milk. What do you think of when you think of Wisconsin cheese? For me, I think cheese curds. Delicious, fresh cheese curds. Or deep-fried cheese curds. Cheese curds literally any way, anytime, any place. I think about Andy Hatch and Upland's Cheese Company. The operation behind the Pleasant Ridge Reserve cheese that's literally America's most awarded cheese. I think of the deliciously stinky Limburger and its long-storied history. I think about Raleigh's Dumbarton Blue, a perfect blend of English-style cheddar and notes of blue. I think of Emmy Roth's Grand Cru Sirchois, which was named 2016's World Champion at the World Championship Cheese Contest. Wisconsin is like the world champion of cheese, and once you start reading the list of cheeses made in Wisconsin on their website, you can see why. The Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board is a nonprofit organization funded entirely by Wisconsin's dairy farm families. Read more at eatwisconsincheese.com, and as soon as you're done listening to this podcast, eat Wisconsin cheese. It's a no-brainer.
Think that dying young is cool, young lion, that's so passe. I think you'll be a brick at 205. Yeah, you'll be kicking whether dead or alive. They'll build a statue or a temple one day to commemorate you when it's old the rodeo. This restlessness.
Welcome back to the Front Burner with Jimmy and Andrew. We've been talking with Chef Marcus Samuelson. So we're into the beginning of February here, which is Black History Month. Mm-hmm. And you have an interesting special menu going on at Red Rooster Harlem.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about it and how it came to be?
Well, I mean, we think about February now. It's when every year we do dinner that we focus on women. I think, you know, for me, this idea that, first of all, women has always been, for me, one of the biggest source of inspiration, actually. My grandmother was a great cook, and I met amazing chefs, like everyone from Julia to Leah Chase to Edna Lewis. So, you know, we want to do every year a menu that represents the past and the present. So last year we had someone like Leah, but also Adrian Cheatham, and just young chefs meeting. But this idea of Black history, you know, we want to challenge that. So we have someone like Princess Pamela that had her restaurant in Lower Manhattan. That was kind of a speakeasy. She cooked at home on second floor. And the Lee brothers are actually coming out with a book about Princess Pamela.
Oh, wow.
And she did a performance in there. She didn't like you. She threw you out. So we're doing a couple of her dishes. We're doing Zarella, Aaron's mother. You know, I just think her badass story about, you know, putting that Mexican restaurant in, but also raising a family. But, you know, like there's so many more other contexts to it.
Yeah.
We
just so people know, this is Zarella Martinez.
Yes.
Who's a very important chef going back to the, I guess, mid-80s in New York City.
Yeah.
Yeah. And as you were saying, her son is probably maybe very well known from his restaurants and television now, Aaron Sanchez.
No, she was a little bit before Dos Caminos, I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah. But then, and then we're celebrating a chef like Lian Wong that worked with me for a long time, and, you know, her Hawaiian food, and she was always doing this Hawaiian local food for us, a staff meal. I mean, and you know, now poke is like the thing. Leanne never thought that moment, right? And then we have a young Dominican chef, that Rosie, that works for us. So it's always this definition of if you're going to label something, well, let's just, you know, let's spread it out a little bit.
Now,
so
what do you mean by that? Because I have to, when I first saw the list, I mean, obviously I thought it was cool. First of all, I think it's cool that you celebrate, you know, women who are
awesome.
You know, cool. Like, you know, it's the struggle of, for representation, for recognition. It seems endless. I mean, it's kind of crazy.
Sure.
2017, we don't need to get into where they've been kind of dissed left and, you know, but still happens in, a lot in, in awards and recognitions and things like that, and opportunity, if we're honest. But it is Black History Month, and I am curious how you came to this more sort of, I guess, what we would call a more expansive definition of what you're doing. And I'm curious to know if you've had any pushback on that.
Yeah, the beauty about pushback is, and I learned this a lot, is that people care. The worst thing is, one thing worse than pushback is no pushback.
Silence.
Indifference.
There is that.
Right.
So, you know, I don't want to be boxed in like that. I mean, there's people of color has always had there's a commonality of a journey.
Yep.
And then there's different exits, right? But that commonality, there's more commonality to celebrate. And, you know, Zarella, I remember when she's still screaming at Aaron, which is great. and I, you know, I've done many events with her and she's awesome. These are all people that have connectivity to the restaurant that has either inspired us or cooked with us. And, you know, I don't know. I want to celebrate this Black History Month the way I want to celebrate it. God knows if it's there next year with the way, you know, the turn we're going right now is probably off, you know, the White House website already, so maybe it's not coming back next year. Who knows?
Right.
Might as well celebrate it while it's here.
Right.
Never know.
You know, I am interested, you know, the way you were talking about Harlem a few minutes ago with the book and these different populations, these different communities that flow through Harlem. You know, some of these women represent communities that do exist. And, you know, I mean, most people do think of Harlem, you know, the casual observer, you know, they think of the, you know, the most iconic things are mostly Black, right? It's, you know, the Cotton Club and Sylvia's and, but, you know, there are other populations that are part of Harlem that are less, less well known to the general public or the public outside of, say, New York City.
Yeah, but that's the beauty of a neighborhood, that you constantly have to reimagine it, right? And especially in New York neighborhood, you constantly have to reimagine, but holding on to something. So, you know, there are the three most iconic restaurants from Harlem. Two of them are Italian. Rayos and Patsy's.
Yep.
They're both from East Harlem.
Yeah.
And then Sylvia's, of course, but two of them are Italian. And so I think that this idea of what something is, it's always more diverse. And I think our opportunity as a beacon is to introduce people to that. And, you know, there's always been a melange. When Mussolini was invading Ethiopia, there was an Italian restaurant in Harlem, and the population in Harlem walked and demonstrated in front of this Italian restaurant in Harlem circa, like, you know, 1890. And imagine the poor Italian waiter there. I'm like, I actually have nothing to do with Mussolini is invading Ethiopia. But there's always, as you dive into this, there's always been this very diverse, high-strung energy. And I love that.
Well, you know, it's funny. There was, the way things get oversimplified as you move further away from their origin point.
Yeah.
There's a book that came out, I think, just last year called What If We're Wrong? By Chuck Klosterman.
Interesting.
And one of the things, and it's the subtitle is something like thinking about the future, thinking about the past from the point of view of the future. Mm-hmm. It's all about how, you know, how often people have been wrong in predicting what's coming. Or not seeing what's coming. And also what he does is looking backwards, look at how these huge complex movements over time get reduced to one or two people, you know?
Yeah.
So like, you know, like there's going to be a time where people are going to say, you know, like 100, you know, in 100 years or whatever, rock and roll. And it's going to be Elvis Presley.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
they won't know. All the other names will fall away. You know, were there playwrights other than William Shakespeare? Sure there were, you know, but we don't, you know, all these eras get just like reduced to the, you know, you see it in this country. You think back to in this profession that we're all talking about.
Fascinating.
You know, the casual observer, early American restaurants, you know, everyone knows Chez Panisse. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of restaurants in the early 70s.
That added to that. Yeah,
yeah, but over time, everything, you know, things tend to fall away. Mm-hmm. And I think the same is true the way people do think about this community that you're in.
But I always like to, you know, the blackness is something that it's an identity that you always been challenged in my life, right? Whether, you know, from being adopted,
sure,
whether growing up in Sweden,
yep,
whether going to Ethiopia where you're not black like us, right?
Yeah.
Whether you're African or African American or, you know, like, so for me, it's like, listen, we've always been the black family on the block, although my parents were white and my cousins were Koreans. So I just also, at some point, I just like, it's about food. I want to eat delicious food.
Yeah.
I want to have like great Cirella's food and some Dominican food and present it. So it's I think this identity piece, and I'm sure like if you think about Jewish culture, it's always similar to that because are you Eastern European? Or are you from,
sure,
are you from the motherland? Or are you from, you know, Bolivia Jewish? Like these are all different types. So in the tribe, we can have that conversation. And then part of being a restaurant is open up that conversation, how it tastes like, to sometimes to the tribe,
yeah,
but sometimes to larger,
yeah,
which is, I think, is so exciting. And again, we're in New York City, and we're not a concept. So let's operate freely. And again, I go back to this word weird. And in when you enter the restaurant right now, there is a piece that I did, that we did, that has half of the face is Tupac and half of the face is David Bowie.
Yeah.
And people just walk up and stare at that. And I'm like, you know, for me, it's very, these are very important things because this is a great intersection of windows into completely different culture. And once you understand Pac, once you understand Bowie, you do understand the rooster.
Well, I do remember coming right not long after you opened. Yeah. Jimmy and I came up with our friend Stephen Eckler for dinner. You were there and you were walking us around and you were showing us, you know. And I remember you said to me, people want to put you in a box and we're not, we don't, that's not how we do it here.
No.
Yeah.
Doing that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's how people are, right? That's how restaurants, if they're a reflection of a personality, right, or of a soul or of a point of view, they're usually not. Those things are not that simple and one dimensional.
And then it's the perception thing. You know, you can be you, but somebody can perceive you as something other than how you feel about yourself. You know?
That's fascinating too, because you actually especially when you're working on something, you're so in your own box.
Yeah,
you're meeting the same crew, you're working.
Sure,
but then you look up and like, oh, that's not how the customer saw it.
Exactly.
And that's been really refreshing with this, you know, online dialogue that people can have, whether they put it on, you know, on Insta or whatever they decide to put it on. We didn't have that before, right? There was the reviews every other third year. There was maybe the Sagats, and that was it.
Right.
Now it's much more a hourly, daily, weekly thing.
Sure.
So, Marcus, before we move off this menu that's available, is it a dinner time menu?
No, we're going to have it. We're going to have some dishes for lunch, but the whole full experience is for dinner.
The full four-course menu is available for dinner. Okay.
Absolutely.
So, we have a couple of minutes. We were talking ahead of time. I'll pay you the ultimate compliment, I think you and I are both tennis fans.
Yes.
Absolutely. And I was talking to someone about Roger, a fellow, I write about tennis a little bit, about Roger Federer recently. And this tennis journalist, who's much more well-known in that world than I am, said to me, you know, the crazy thing about Roger is he always seems to have time. Mm. He seems to have time on the court. He seems to have time in the press room. Wow. This is the most, maybe the best tennis player ever. You know, he does post-match press conferences in several languages. You know, it's been striking to me, and I would think maybe to Jimmy too, you know, watching as you're, because we knew you when you first got here.
Yeah.
And you know, you've got restaurants around the world. You've got, you know, I'm holding your book here. You've been involved in various television projects. You have a restaurant coming up in London.
Yeah.
You always seem sort of, you know, you were here the day your Harlem Eat Up Festival started about last year. You always seem sort of unrushed. You always seem very focused on whoever's with you. How do you... And I'm not just blowing smoke when I say this. A lot of people who know Marcus would say this. But how do you – give us a window into how you keep yourself organized and allocated in a way that – you know, you have a family.
Yeah.
How do you keep this together? What's the team that you have? I don't need names. No. But, I mean, what's your system and how have you worked this out for yourself?
No, but I'm always excited, first of all, to come here, right? Like, that's like – it's meaningful to me. I love seeing you guys and
Thank you.
Like, I don't want to know what the questions are. Like, I want to get into it. And so I'm excited about this. This is actually my lunch break. You know what I mean? No, but it's a good one. You know what I mean? And that helps versus – especially in a day when you're – building something and you're fixing something, and it's, you know, the day cannot just be about how many covers did we do last night, you know what I mean? Because I think that will burn you out. Our industry is, yes, you guys know, it's easy to burn out because it's just this monotone, just like Jimmy said, you got to go back and repeat and repeat and repeat. So that's a huge part of this, feeling emotionally connected and having a good conversation, right? And then the other part, I mean, my team that works for me, they're awesome. So many things that I'm not, right? I'm lucky enough to, we picked a team that, you know, the woman who's head of the purse, she sits on it and she's really good at that. And she tells me what to do. And I love that. Derek that does our you know, marketing and all of that stuff. It works with Philip very, very closely. So I'm like, I don't have to, I still want to get involved, which line cook is coming up and where is she working and why isn't she going to Sweden versus him, or, you know.
So do you keep most of your personal time and energy these days still in the restaurant?
Yeah,
that's where most of your time is. You still...
Office is right there and my house is right there and the team is there. And then out of that, we operate whether I go to Sweden, London, whatever I do. But it's very much, I want to focus on that. I want to focus on the food, the team, the front of the house team, the back of the house team, and the artistic movement of the company, right? I like accountants, but that's not what I got into the industry. I'm not good at it.
Right.
And I acknowledge that I'm not good at it.
You know?
But it's very important. It's super important, otherwise
we're
not in business. But I'm not going to be like, no, you can actually do this a little bit better. Like, I have an iPhone, doesn't mean I know how it works.
Well, what's interesting to me about this is, I actually interviewed someone not long ago about Wolfgang Puck.
Yeah.
And they were saying, you know, the amazing thing about him is, you know, 40 years after he started his career in the States, that guy still likes to cook.
Of course.
And still likes to be in the restaurants.
Yeah.
And it's sort of, you know, as you're talking, you know, it is interesting because that's not always the case now. A lot of chefs, and I'm not putting it down. Yeah. I think it's really important. I always say I don't begrudge anyone their empire. Mm-hmm. If they're happy moving away from the kitchen, that's fine. Mm-hmm. I think to complain about that too much, it's just not things. We've been talking about evolution here today, right?
Yeah.
Things do change. This industry has morphed. It's not what it used to be.
Yeah.
But it is, for me, heartening. I do love hearing that you still have, you've tried to arrange your business in a way that allows not to lose touch with those kitchens.
I am a food nerd, right? Like, there's no, if I wouldn't have a restaurant, I would read, dream, eat, cook this anyway. Right.
That is,
and I think it's more exciting today because you don't know, like, you know, there's a corner restaurant in D.C. that I got to get to. And they just did this thing. And when I hear about it, and I haven't been there, and one of my manager, line cooks, has been there, I'm pissed. Do you know what I mean? And as long as you have that, you're going to keep having fun. The minute you don't have it, and we need to take pause, right? There was a pause between Aquavit and Red Rooster. I needed that. I missed it. Like, after 3 months, I'm like, fuck.
Yeah.
Like, starting to itch. And then some people, that's not the right venue for them to go back to.
Right.
But for me, it has. So I think that's very, very important. And each chef's going to settle them themselves. But, you know, as we speak and think about our buddy Waxman, for example, that, you know, like, his elevator is amazing, right? He knows, you know, the dishwasher in Nashville, and he knows, you know, like, someone all the way over here, right? If his elevators, and Wolfgang, you talk about Danielle.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't think Danielle is yelling at someone at this very moment, right? But it's a good yell, right?
Yeah.
I mean, thank God. And I'm like, when I worried about that, when Wolf and Danielle is not doing it anymore, like, that's my compass, right? That's true of Jonathan. Those are my compasses. So when they're not, I mean, Jonathan's a different approach than Danielle, but like, if they're not pushing, like, then maybe it gets weary for me, you know?
Well, then it'll be on you.
Yeah.
It'll be your turn to be that.
But I'm not ready, do you know what I mean?
Well.
Yes, you are.
Yeah.
You're never ready for the next role, right? Yes, you know? Yeah. No one's ever qualified for the next job.
You're right.
We'll give you a little break in between.
Yeah, in between.
Get you fired up.
Oh, good, good, good.
What else can you, what else, we got a minute or two. You're still, London's still coming up for you?
London,
you're going to do Red Rooster in London?
Yeah, we're building in Shoreditch, and it takes time, and obviously the Brexit thing put us a little bit in. Because we wanted a lot of stuff from Sweden, and we just have to refigure it out. But I think by spring, we're there, like May, June, a spring opening, and East London, it's so different. It's a writer's community. You have a little bit of, you have great Indian restaurants there.
A lot of soul.
You have good lox, you have good Jewish restaurant down the street. So it's like, you know, I get my lox down there, and I feel like, so we probably going to have herring in the restaurant, which I'm super excited about.
Nice.
You know, so it's good. It's just yummy to get in there and deal with the Brits, you know, it's good.
Great. Well, Marcus, we're out of time. Time flies.
Yes.
Could do this all day.
All day.
It's great to see you. Marcus's recent book is Red Rooster, the Cookbook, The Story of Food and Hustle in Harlem. The special Black History Month menu featuring the four-course menu by the four women chefs that we talked about is being featured throughout the month of February 2017 at Red Rooster Harlem. We wish you all the best with everything
you're
doing, and thank you for coming out to Brooklyn.
Thank you
to visit
for
us.
Having me. Thank you, Jimmy. Thank you, Drew.
And Jimmy, thanks for being here.
Here we go. Check it out.
That's it for this week's show. Jimmy and I will see you back here next week. Oh, I should say, sorry, you can follow us on Twitter at Chef Podcast, and you can follow The Front Burner with Jimmy and Andrew on Facebook. Jimmy's restaurant is The Red Cat in the Chelsea neighborhood of New York City. And we'll see you back here next week on The Front Burner with Jimmy and Andrew.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.